You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We're the sidewalk in.
804. We go from gravy, talking turkey gravy, to talking transgender issues with Dan Lamont of the Washington Post. But before we talk, before we show the range of the program, we're going to stretch it even further. Dan, first of all, good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning. I'm doing well.
Are you a George Strait fan?
Not really.
Right.
I'm more of a rock and roll guy.
All right. Now, after the Yankees acquired Giancarlo Stanton, I checked out the Twitter feed under hashtag Yankees, and what I saw was hysterical Red Sox fans, euphorious Yankee fans. It was probably one of the most It was one of the funnier Twitter feeds I've seen in a long time. Are you guys resigned as a Red Sox guy? Are you resigned to the fact that the Red Sox will never win another division title again? How are you coping with all of this?
I'm looking at it a lot different, I guess. Maybe I'm more of an optimist after three titles in the last so many years.
Oh! That was then. Are we talking history now? Are we going to do a history lesson? We're talking about the future, Dan. Come on.
No, I hear you, but past and prologue and all that. I think it's a situation where it's a great trade. They got him very cheap.
Yeah.
But they're still going to have to pay him an awful lot, and he does get injured a lot. So I think it's the kind of thing that look really good for a couple of years, and at some point it might be another applesauce.
Nice. So you're calling Giancarlo Stanton A-Rod now, the second coming of A-Rod.
I think it's entirely possible.
All right. You wrote an article. I was trying to get my hands around the transgender issue, so I was doing a little reading on it, and ran across an article that you wrote about almost a year and a half, not quite a year and a half ago. I want to say in July, I think, of 2016. And you see numbers thrown around by people that say there's 13,000 transgender service members. And you just look, you're like, are you kidding me? Transgender, that's people who are one sex and are trying to have hormone therapy, sex change operations to be another sex. And then as I begin to read about it, I find as I start going through footnotes, that's not exactly how transgender is defined. I wanted to have you on to kind of talk about the article that you wrote and then kind of fast forward it and update it to what the DOD is going through now. So give us a couple minutes of general education on the transgender issue that the DOD faces.
Sure. And candidly, this is something that I had to learn a lot about kind of as I was working my way through the reporting process myself. Transgender issues are partly what you said, but it's also a number of other individuals who identify as one gender when they were the other at birth. Some of them will go through the whole gamut of reassignment surgery, hormones, the whole nine. Other people do not. So it becomes a lot more complicated than simply what you said. In terms of defining, and I think that also makes it more difficult to count, more difficult to understand, and more difficult to identify. There are times where I don't think people necessarily know if they have a transgender individual in their unit. It's not always that clear.
I will tell you that was, I won't say shocking to me, but it certainly explained that definition, for me anyway, began to explain how that number could, how what I thought was a very, very minuscule number, actually in truth be maybe 13,000 because of that, so if you're, what do they call it, dysphoria?
Sexual dysphoria. That's the clinical definition.
Right. So you're essentially dislocated between what you have in your brain and what you are physically. That doesn't line up for you. And that dislocation could have you under the broad heading of transgender, although you may never elect to have any kind of hormone treatment, as Dan said, or surgery. And when you hear that, even you know, the not too bright among us go, okay, now what? Because that means that there's a whole spectrum of people that this policy is going to have to cover, which is really not what I thought. The logical syllogism from McNamara is this. The Department of Defense and the United States military makes its living on human widgets. We have to be interchangeable. To the extent that you can't be interchangeable, you can't serve. If you're a diabetic, we can't support your medical needs. Right? If you have bad knees, we can't support that. You have to go. So there's a whole series of reasons, mental and physical, that we disqualify people all the time. And my understanding is the hormone treatment that goes with gender reassignment surgery is not conducive to deploying to expeditionary places where you don't have refrigerators and things like that. And so for those reasons, we don't allow diabetics. We can't support their medical needs. And so McNamara says, in I don't care what you are sexually or who you want to have sex with, okay? It's irrelevant to me. I care that you can do your job. But I can't support your hormone treatment in the middle of the Helmand province with no refrigerator and adversely impact you. So therefore, you're disqualified. Now, that makes sense to me, that McNamara's policy. However, as the definition broadens, my policy becomes certainly way too limited for the scope of the issue. So if that's the definition, what are the biggest challenges the DOD faces in creating a policy for this transgender community?
Looking at the issues and looking at some of the things that they've already identified, one of them is education. It's helping others understand that this is not necessarily the stereotype they think it is.
Right.
That it's a range of things, that it's probably individuals that they've interacted with over the course of their career already, that in some cases it's quite serious and does require sort of these more significant things like surgery, but that in other cases it's as simple as taking a pill in the morning. You know, I go to Helmand as an embed. I took Claritin with me. You know, it didn't make it where I couldn't go. It just made it where I needed to take a pill every morning.
Right.
You know, just for standard allergies and hay fever. If it's something more simple to that effect, and this is more on a case-by-case basis, that it takes nuance, really, when you look at this issue.
Okay, so how does the DOD, okay, first of all, what's the number one issue relative to this?
Not sure I understand the question.
So if we say that if you're physically capable and mentally capable and you meet our standards, you can serve. When you look at the transgender community and you try to formulate a policy, what's the number one thing you have to address? And let's assume that we begin the education process for the rest of the force in terms of here's the spectrum of people. This is what they deal with, right? Once you do the education piece, for the DOD, what becomes problematic relative to transgender service?
I mean, there are complications when it comes to integration into a unit. Some of this, again, is going to be case by case. You know, if you've got supportive commanders, commanders who've kind of done their homework versus commanders who have not, that becomes a potentially difficult situation. It takes education and understanding on the part of the individual who is transgender. You know, they probably to some extent throughout their lives, but especially if they've been identified openly, are going to have to deal with questions, probably going to have to deal with, you know, discomfort on the part of some of their peers, and you know, assumedly that would make things uncomfortable for them at times as well.
Right.
You know, this runs the gamut from very, very serious and very difficult to ever deploy to probably no big deal.
Right.
You know, at least when you're talking to scientists, individuals who have done it. I mean, you look at individuals like Kristen Beck, the Navy SEAL that came out as transgender and ran for Congress. I mean, there's a real range to it.
My guest from the Washington Post, Dan LaMoth. All right, so the president and the secretary of defense don't seem to be on the same sheet of music relative to the dance that we've seen get done. Give me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, we're in a complicated time. I think we're in a complicated time, particularly for commanders who have transgender people in their unit already, the transgender individuals themselves, and for the policymakers in the Pentagon. Where we are at this point is out of the blue, in the middle of the summer, President Trump tweets a sort of absolute-sounding policy of absolutely no transgender individuals being allowed in the military.
Right.
But there was absolutely zero legwork, policy work that had been done at that point. So the Pentagon immediately, General Dunford actually, put down a letter the following day, a memo saying, hey, we will do nothing until we have basically details to go with this. Nothing changes for the time being. You will treat everybody with respect, as we always do. And, you know, until we have some level of details, we will carry out the commander-in-chief's intent once we have specifics. President Trump seems to have delegated a lot of this to Secretary Mattis. There's a timeline where by late February, Secretary Mattis is due to deliver recommendations. The Pentagon is said to be studying all this right now, primarily through the lens of what makes us the most combat effective.
Right.
By late March, they're supposed to make an announcement. This is even more complicated by the fact that while that timeline is playing out, there's also lawsuits that have been filed in a number of different jurisdictions saying, we already went through this, we've already been cleared to serve, and you're basically pushing through the courts to keep transgender service open. At the current time, the resolution or at least litigation process has it where judges in two different jurisdictions have said transgender service should continue. The Pentagon has to be open effective January 1 to transgender recruits and otherwise. So you've kind of got this timeline where on one hand, January 1 hits, transgender service is legally allowed. And the Pentagon, at least at this time, has been court-ordered to do that. But on the flip side, are still carrying out a study and have, at least according to the White House's timeline, until late February to deliver recommendations.
Okay, give me your thoughts on what some have written and discussed as General Dunford's and General Mattis's insubordination relative to the president.
That's a complicated issue, and I think when you look at it through what they're dealing with, they're trying to be faithful to as many people as possible under their own command. The president has dictated a policy, but didn't appear to do the details that went with it. So they're trying to kind of suss out, okay, we already have brought in people, we already have people that have identified, you know, like there were transgender individuals in the military who never said a word about it until after transgender service was openly allowed. Do you now dump all those individuals out? How many people do you lose? What to do to the units? What have they been trained in? Are they in specialties where we're already shorthanded? Like there's all those sort of additional levels that don't necessarily always make you more combat effective. So I don't know. I mean, there doesn't appear to be friction, at least that's been expressed by President Trump toward Mattis, toward Dunford, over this issue yet. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not this becomes a friction point on the open side, or whether or not they're just going to sort through it, and he's going to kind of leave it to the generals to take care of.
Here's an email for you. Mac, probably like you, I had no idea relative to the complexity of the issue. I simply assumed, like most of us do, that everybody labeled transgender was seeking reassignment surgery. My question for Dan is, was it simply an executive order by Barack Obama that allowed transgender service, or was there anything that went with it? It sounds to me like President Obama was just as hasty in allowing it as President Trump was in disallowing it. Both, to me, sound irresponsible. It sounds like General Dunford and Secretary Mattis are steering the appropriate course towards greater study, the due diligence needed for a complex issue like this, in order to be fair to Americans who genuinely want to serve and can physically and mentally do that. So my question really centers around the basis for the permission in the first place. Dan?
There's a whole backstory there that was big in the news at the time, but appears, based at least on that email, to probably be overlooked to some extent. If we go back to, I believe it was summer 2016, I might be off on that, it might be even before that, Secretary Carter, the Pentagon chief under Obama, the last one, said, we are moving toward inclusiveness, we are going to study transgender service, whether or not it's possible, whether or not there are limits on it, and basically what makes sense. And we are going to set up a timeline, I believe it was 6 months at the time, where we will study this and, you know, we will reach a decision. That dragged out for the better part of a calendar year, despite the 6 months set up front as a timeline, to the point where you had people like me writing stories on Page One about this sort of lag study and the uncertainty and, you know, the question marks and the daggers that the LGBT community was throwing at the Pentagon because they couldn't get their act together and meet their own timeline. All of that was playing out. Eventually, Secretary Carter reached a decision with a lot of policy and documents and guidance behind it where the Open Transgender Service, with documentation and a commander's guidance and all of that that went out right along with it. Here's how it works. Here's how we will do it. Here's how you should do it if you have one, you know, an individual like this in your unit, et cetera, et cetera. The one piece that was not decided at that time was what to do with openly transgender people who are applying to join the military. The idea being that we knew there were transgender people already in the military. Some of these people come to this conclusion after they join. Some of these people have been struggling with years. It's a range.
Right.
So if they're already in and they're doing their job well, you know, here are the things that we could do. And there was a set of criteria for that. The thing that they were still looking at is whether or not it made sense to accept openly transgender individuals as recruits. And that was the piece that became a sticking point, even going back to last June, 6 months ago, where Secretary Mattis had a study on that piece still going. And there was a deadline that had been set ahead of the Trump administration taking over where they would make a judgment call on that in June. Secretary Mattis in June said, I want another 6 months. We're going to study this at greater length. So basically a study on top of a study. Some people took exception to that at the time as though, you know, basically by calling for another study, you're more or less kicking the can down the road. That's really making a decision unto itself.
Right.
And then with that study already ongoing, President Trump put out his tweets in the middle of the summer and more or less kind of exacerbated this situation that was already kind of up in the air. And the Pentagon has said, hey, we're already studying this. We'll reach our conclusions. And you have this situation where the policy and Secretary Mattis's look at this didn't square up with the Pentagon, didn't square up with President Trump's tweets, and there was a lot of uncertainty for a while, and there still is.
Another email. Mac, interesting stuff this morning. my question for Dan is this. This group is notorious for high rates of suicide and mental instability. That's what I've read. I'm not sure that it's all true after listening to this discussion. Maybe the population is more diverse. Are those not red flags, or is that what these studies are determining?
The answer is more the latter, and there is some statistical validity to that concern. There are higher rates of suicide. There are higher rates of needing counseling, things like that. So the question becomes, all right, we have a number of populations of people that we already look at as potential recruits who have these concerns. You know, suicide is already a problem. When you start looking at at-risk families, suicide is also higher in that population.
Right.
That's a population the military often recruits from. So they're trying to sort through what makes sense, what doesn't, and does the existing screening process for those sorts of issues, suicide, mental illness, et cetera, will that work for the transgender population as well?
Got it. Another email for you. Is the decision still expected from Secretary Mattis in the spring? And is that decision solely on new recruits? And where does the president's action stand relative to legality? So what is the picture today, Dan? There, the court has said that the military has to begin taking recruits by 1 January. The president's executive order is being challenged in court that would prohibit that, yes?
Yes. You have a situation where the Justice Department is challenging court orders that say, effective January 1, the Pentagon needs to accept not only the transgender individuals already in the military, but transgender individuals who would like to be recruits in the military.
Right.
At this point, that has been challenged at several levels, and the courts continue to strike down challenges by the Trump administration to ban transgender service, to ban transgender money for transgender surgery, and a variety of other nuances along those lines. So we're in a situation where the timeline still says the Pentagon will submit their recommendations in late February, and the Trump administration will likely issue their new policy in late March. Meanwhile, the courts are saying not good enough. January 1, you have to take transgender individuals across the board. And you're going to end up with this situation, at least at this point, where anybody recruited between, say, 1 January and late March, there's some uncertainty over whether or not, if you come into the service, what will happen to you if you are transgender. Will you be allowed to stay? Will you be allowed to commission? And all those sorts of things are still up in the air. There are also individuals, for example, Air Force Academy and West Point both had this come up, where people went through the program, graduated, and then were not allowed to commission because they were still not taking new individuals into the military that were transgender. So they were accepted, they did the 4 years, they were ready to sign up, they were ready to, take the commission, and they are still also kind of like left in limbo. And, they graduated these academies in May and June, and then here we are 6 months later, and they are still not allowed in the military despite going to these academies and graduating.
A veritable mess. Okay, but that's the lay of the land, and so the way this will work itself out is, explain that. Obviously, the court challenges will go through the court, and they will rule on the president's executive order. The Department of Defense here this spring will make a decision on what transgender service ought to be across the board, yes? The study that they're doing now is broader than simply recruits, yes or no?
Yes, it's okay. All of the above. The recruits piece was the sort of the last wicket that they had not hit, going back to when Secretary Carter issued his policy change. At the time, one would certainly think President Obama was supportive of this. He certainly had say on this, at least in terms of, you know, issuing support for it after the decision had been made. With that said, they do seem to have let the Pentagon dictate its own timeline, and that timeline did lag quite a bit. I would actually wonder myself how much pressure was on the Pentagon a year and a half ago when the timeline that Secretary Carter set for himself and the rest of the department was not met. That, for a period of 6-7 months, was all uncertain. And the White House kept quiet throughout.
Got it. My guest, Dan Lamothe from the Washington Post, been gracious enough to give us his time at the end of a pretty busy week. Dan, let me switch. First of all, is there anything that we haven't discussed relative to this issue that people ought to know to make their knowledge more complete in terms of understanding?
I think the numbers piece is something that's worth probably talking about for a second at least. I've seen the number as high as 13,000 in some of these studies. The study that I tend to quote from the most frequently is a RAND study that the Pentagon paid for. In that one, they said the most likely number was somewhere between 2,200 and 6,000 among the million-plus members on active duty. So not quite as high. Right. And then when you threw in the reserve and everything else, then the number might have been a hair higher. But they themselves were, even in that study with the scientists involved and everything else, said it's kind of hard to pin it down more than that. And that is as close as anybody has really gotten to trying to identify this. I actually asked myself, Secretary Mattis, his thoughts on that study during one of his engagements with the press a couple months ago. And he expressed some skepticism and an uncertainty over whether or not those numbers were valid. It more or less wasn't saying he was believing the numbers or not, more that he just thought it needed additional study and that he was not, quote, signing up for that, that he was not signing off on that being 100% true.
No, you know, one of the things that is interesting about him and having worked for him is when he hears a number that doesn't make sense, that in some way, shape, or form, surprises him. He approaches the number just, you know, looking for the footnotes of it. Hey, where does this come from? Where, tell me about this aspect of it. Tell me about this piece of it. And what he'll do is if it doesn't make sense to him, he'll ask you to come sit down and make him smarter about it. I mean, he is, at his heart, among the variety of thing he is, he's an intellectual. He tries never to come across as that, but he is. And he knows how to do it. And the first thing is, reconcile this with me, and then he begins to pull the string on that. And so, to me, that's very much in keeping of what I saw him do on a daily basis in Iraq. The numbers piece. All right. Anything else we ought to know?
I think those are probably the basics at this point. You know, at this point, there are already transgender individuals in a variety of units. I recall interviewing a individual who swapped gender from male to female, but was still assigned to an Army infantry unit, and at last check still was out in Lewis McChord. So even in combat units, this is already happening. This has been happening. So I think anybody who's saying, you know, we don't want to start this is missing that. Now, whether or not it's working or not, whether or not it's overall, you know, making sense, you know, out from the outside, I'm not making a judgment on that. That's not my job.
Right. Got it. All right. Let me switch gears. You're now in the broadcasting profession. You're doing podcasts. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's actually been a lot of fun. It's been kind of a breath of fresh air to do something different. About a year and a half ago, a Marine vet approached the Washington Post saying that he had obtained about 600, 700, 800, and I honestly still haven't counted, letters that were all written during World War II among one family. three brothers served in the military, four brothers overall. One was a Marine in the Guadalcanal campaign. One was an Army infantryman who served in the Marshals and in the Aleutians, which is kind of an overlooked campaign, I think. There's a third brother in the Army Air Forces, and then a fourth one who worked in factories back home. And kind of going through these letters, we made a judgment call to kind of blow the story out, do something pretty dramatic with it, because these letters were, frankly, gripping at times. You know, first-hand accounts of, you know, very vicious battles, hand-to-hand combat in a couple cases, you know, accounts of, you know, waking up in the morning with piles of Japanese bodies around one of the brothers' units, things along those lines. So we went into a very long process in between the other reporting I do that on a day-to-day level where we put together a story that was probably the longest thing I've written at the Post. We included a ton of graphics. We included the actual letters in some cases. And then on top of that, we launched this podcast called Letters from War. And we brought in some modern-day vets to play the parts of these individuals who wrote these letters. And the podcast is kind of done in narrative fashion, where you've got the brothers recounting what they saw, what they did in the letters. I narrate in between. They pull in a ton of natural sound. They pull in a ton of you know famous speeches by people like Churchill, and kind of just trace the entire war through the eyes of this one family. We've dropped two episodes so far, and basically every Wednesday on the Washington Post site, we're dropping additional.
So where do we find it? So if you're familiar with the Washington Post website, stand by. Where do we find this podcast?
We launched a separate page, so it's easy to find. It's washingtonpost.com/lettersfromwar. You can sign up like you do for other podcasts, or you know, it'll just naturally download. Okay. For people that are not into that, you can also just click play on the website and you know, listen to it or watch it like any other recording.
Okay, so where do I find, so I'm on the website right now. How do I navigate to find it?
The easiest way, on top of, you know, the WashingtonPost.com is just add a slash, in the address,
right,
and add Letters from War at the end.
Okay. All right. / Letters from War. Oh. 700 letters from the same family. And they hail from Illinois, I see.
Yeah, it's kind of a bizarre story how these letters kind of came to us. It's a family from Illinois. None of them had children, and the last surviving brother sort of collected all of this as he got into his older years. When he died, they were turned over to a sort of unofficial historian in the family, who would have been a cousin of his, and they were brought out to Arizona. When she died, the letters were either already in storage or placed in storage. That storage unit ultimately went unpaid. They do almost like you see on Storage Wars.
Right.
They were put up for bid. The bid was put in without anyone even knowing what was in the unit. The unit opens up, and the individual who won the bid happened to be a guy who served in the Marines briefly in the 80s.
Wow.
And he kind of started sorting through this and said, "Oh my God, this is amazing." I think on his own, kind of poked at this on and off for years to see if he could find a closest surviving family member or more information. He spent quite a deal of time with this reading the letters himself, but I think he didn't quite know how to get there and wasn't able to find anyone. So he turned over to us kind of with this mystery as well. I was able to find surviving family members and get the additional story and family photographs and, you know, obituaries and documents. And I was able to put in a Freedom of Information Act request for these individual service records as well. Some of them burned in the big fire that many people are aware of at the Personnel Records Center that the military has. There's not a lot of old Army records left. But the oldest brother, Frank Ide, His records were in a different wing because he was Navy Department. And there's kind of this whole fascinating backstory of how he goes from being a scout in a tank unit in the Guadalcanal campaign to coming home to being put in a hospital with what appears to be paranoia and some level of combat fatigue. And he struggles on and off for years with hospitals and mental diagnoses and things of that sort. And you know, you've got one brother who's really struggling. Meanwhile, another one is wounded in two different battles and, you know, kind of copes with those sorts of details and ultimately comes out looking, you know, he serves for years in different capacities in the government.
What time period do the letters cover?
The bulk of them run from the late 30s to about 1965.
Wow.
But there are letters that stretch all the way into the 1980s.
Wow. Wow. So how you guys are going to produce a whole series on this family?
Yes. The plan is a five-part narrative series. Each episode runs about 20 minutes or so. Kind of just tracing the story through their eyes and sort of unofficially through their voices. We also have a two-part discussion where the modern-day vets who read these parts kind of weigh in on what matches with their own experiences and their own service. And those modern-day vets have been pretty amazing. We've got a Force Recon Marine who's about to medically retire, reading the part of the Marine. We've got a couple people who served in the Air Force, a soldier. There's a Navy helicopter pilot. I mean, we put out a big call out, and you know they came back, and a couple of the editors narrowed it down to five or six, and we tried to assign parts that seemed to be a good fit based on their speaking styles and other things like that.
Wow. Wow. What has been, so far, you said it's been an enjoyable experience. What is the biggest challenge relative to bringing this story to life?
One of the big challenges was organization. When you're talking this volume of information and basically reading through hundreds and hundreds of letters, ultimately to probably quote from 20 of them.
Wow.
But you kind of needed to read them all to understand the full story. So it was, you know, like, all right, you know, are you putting post-it notes on these? How are you categorizing these?
How are you tagging it?
Sort of all of that level of detail. You know, do you organize them by brother, by battle, by year? And ultimately it became a little bit of all of those.
Right, I was going to say, that's how.
It's almost like breaking down the podcast set.
It's almost like breaking down, film, for a football team or a sports team. You know, this is what they do on the power play. This is what they do, 5-on-4. This is what they do 4-on-3, right? And you tag it all these different ways. So then when you go back, you know, you can say, okay, I want to see all the comments related to, it's got to be a huge, how did you do that? You can't do it with, I guess you could do it with stickies, but it's a lot of letters to get through with a lot of stickies. How did you ultimately, do you tag it electronically and then are able to source it like that?
Yeah, we ultimately, and then thank God I had help with this. We ultimately, as a group, the letters were transcribed. There were a couple digital editors involved in that. There were a couple copy aides involved in that where, you know, their job for the day became, all right, I'm going to transcribe and actually type in these letters that I have on what effectively was tissue paper, and type all that in, so that we can, you know, then, you know, put it in different folders and, you know, and then sort of in a, you know, like Dropbox internet environment, kind of put these things into different folders so that, you know, like if you're looking by year, it's easy to find. If you're looking by brother, it's easy to find. And, you know, 'cause you're trying to both overlay a timeline here with each of the individual brothers' stories, and you know there's a whole range of material that in the draft that I turned in, we had to leave on the cutting room floor. That was just, you know, you can only go so long.
Right. Email question, Mac. Are the letters available to view online? Dan?
Yes, some of them are. We scanned in some of the best ones. The actual story itself that went online was done with a what they call here a graphics template, which basically in layman's terms mean that they were able to make it where when you scroll down the page, the letters will actually open up in front of you on the actual story. On that that web address that I gave, the WashingtonPost.com letters from war, that brings you to the podcast page, but at the bottom of that, there's links to the story and then to a first-person thing that I wrote that kind of walks readers through the process of, you know, how I did this and, you know, kind of my own family history, because this made me go hunting for my own family history on World War II as well.
Got it. All right. Anything that you want people to know about your new career in broadcasting that I haven't been smart enough to ask you yet?
Nothing comes to mind. Just that this was an entirely different experience. You know, you get to the point where you're editing it not just for fact, but also for things like tone of voice.
Right.
When I'm narrating this, there were a couple times where we had to recut things and re-record things where it's like, you know, your voice sounds a bit harsh there. Your voice sounds a bit, too excited there. And we kind of had to there were times where I would read the same line five different ways to figure out what sounded the best.
Right. Now, you know, the power of voice, when you do this for a living, you hear it. And that's why I think, audio is so compelling in terms of whether it be telling somebody's story and how you tell it or when somebody tells their own story and the power in that. Yeah, the editing part of it is huge. All right, sir, first of all, thank you very much for doing this. Let me read you one more email. That's, hey, Mac, I just want to say thanks for the education today and earlier this week relative to the transgender issue. I had no idea. I'm sure I sounded as much of a redneck as other guys do relative to the transgender thing. The bottom line is that these are Americans just like the rest of us. They come with their own set of issues. But if they're medically qualified and physically qualified, I think you meant mentally, they ought to be allowed to serve. It is the way this country has been put together. Lamoth has been great today in terms of explaining the broader context of the issues and where they sit today. Well done. Thank you very much. So, Lamoth, well done. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, bud. Good luck with the whole Red Sox thing, too. I hope you guys make it.
Well, good luck in second place.
All right, man. Thank you very much, Dan. Take care.
Take care.
All right, there you have it. From the Washington Post, that is Dan Lamoth, who's – and check it out. The again, the website is called – go to WashingtonPost.com. And then if you go / letters from war, you'll find that. So, can you imagine that? 700 letters in a storage site. 700 letters in a storage site. That's pretty amazing. All right, we're taking a break. More of, we'll check some news headlines, and then we'll give the Gunner a shout out. We may not check too many headlines, but we'll check a few. We'll get through the early bird and the front of Marine Corps Times. So, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled machine anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOC community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Friday, Mike McNamara with you. Interesting email. Mac, I want to be against transgender service, but I think as Americans, it reminds me of the argument relative to and I just got distracted by something I saw. In terms of whether you morally like it or not, the Constitution says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It doesn't qualify that. So in a country that embraces that as its own constitution, what is the compelling public interest to bar transgender service? I'll be very interested to see what the DOD Undersecretary Mattis produces. As you said, knowing him and the intellect he has, he will want to get to ground truth on the issue in terms of what is best for the Department of Defense and what is fair to them. Interesting discussion. As I said, I want to be against their service, but I don't feel comfortable given everything I've seen in this country. Lamoth is a good interview. Too bad he's a Red Sox fan. Yeah, that's right. Too bad he's a Red Sox fan. Said the Yankees are going to finish in third place? Come on. All right, we'll go through a few headlines. On Marine Corps Times, top headline, changes in special duty assignments will allow more Marines to deploy. Fewer Marines will be selected in January to begin screening for special duty assignments. Now, special duty is a big deal in the Marine Corps. And we'll talk about here real quick. But drill instructors are certainly a part of that. The Marine Corps has reduced the number of duties that require special duty assignments. Lengthy screening process from 5 to 3. Recruiters, drill instructors, and Marine Security Guard detachment commanders, according to a newly released MAR admin. Typically, about 8,600 Marines are selected each January to begin screening for special duty assignments the following fiscal year. With fewer special duty assignments, the list of Marines selected for fiscal 2019 is expected to shrink by 40%. Because the screening is so stringent, it can take up to 18 months before Marines are ready to begin training for these assignments. Once you fill up a class, you can't say, oh, well, I want to send that guy to Task Force Al-Assad, and I need to replace him. Sergeant Major Troy Black, who's the senior enlisted leader for the Manpower and Reserve Affairs. Okay, now I have to go rescreen 20 people to find one qualified. Under the latest change, Marine Corps combat instructors, Marine Corps security guard watch standards will be classified as Type 1 billets, in a newly created category. Those billets have less restrictive selection criteria compared to special duty assignments, Black said. For example, a Marine with several children can still serve stateside as a combat instructor because there is a support structure in place for his or her family. But a Marine Security Guard Detachment Commander cannot count on having that level of family support overseas, he said. As of now, there will be no change in pay for Marines in special duty assignments, yada, yada, yada. So, again, the number of billets decreased. The number of billets decreased so that the number of Marines available to deploy that aren't getting yanked out of that and put in some holding status is increased. U.S. F-22s intercepted a Russian fighter firing warning flares, and that happened over eastern Syria. The Russians historically are idiots when it comes to this stuff. They constantly wanna poke you in the chest, and it's the game they play. They played it for decades, so whatever. It's nothing new. It's been going on forever. Marines are Marines continue work started in Helmand Province a couple years ago on autonomous helicopters. Yeah, remotely piloted helicopters. So that's in the news. And then yesterday, if you missed it, Nikki Haley gave a little bit of a speech. She was standing in front of a spent Iranian missile that was fired from Yemen into Saudi Arabia. So pretty graphic evidence. As the United States continues to push on Iran and essentially square up with Iran as well. So, interesting. So those are the major headlines, in the Marine Corps Times. Early bird, number one is a story about the Russian intercept. Two, as tensions ease, China keeps building on disputed islands. So that was in the news yesterday. Islands in the South China Sea continue to be fortified over the course of the last year. Number three, a large number of American companies supplying the U.S. military may have left the defense market, according to a study announced on Thursday, raising alarm over the health and future of the defense industrial base. Now, again, this goes to sequestration and all the rest of this stuff, that Congress doesn't do their job. And so it's, again, it's just one more reason to look at Congress and put your hands in the air and say you are doing harm to the nation. All right, number four story is the full FY 2018 defense budget at center of the latest government threat to shut it down, and that's in the Military Times, and then this story about the U.S. military's needs in terms of the fight in Europe. Other Marine Corps stories, you've already heard them all. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll get the gunner on. We'll talk to him on a Friday. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the home fort, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs at allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.